Do you swear on the Constitution of the United States to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
This is Police Radio,
the voice of American law enforcement,
with your host, Randy Sutton.
Hello, and welcome to Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. Thank you so much for joining me today. We've got a great show for you. Wonderful guest. And before we go into the briefing room where I'm going to give you my view from the blue, I want to thank those that make this show possible. JSD Security, which is the 21st century security company. Warrior12.com. Warrior12.com, if you want the coolest Blue Lives Matter t-shirts, that's where you go. Warrior 12. And of course, Blue Lives Matter. BlueLivesMatter.blue. is our website, and catch us on Facebook as well. And also, come see me on Facebook. Look at Randy Sutton, public figure. Like it, follow it, and believe it or not, I'm doing Twitter now at LT Randy Sutton. So come Twitter me or tweet me, whatever it's called. The other thing I want to tell you about is my book. I have several books on Amazon.com. The first is True Blue, Police Stories by Those Who Have Lived Them. Then another one called A Cop's Life. And the third, True Blue to Protect and Serve. I think you'll like those books. Take a look at them. They're available on Kindle and also the actual real old-fashioned book. So take a look at it, Amazon.com. Now, let's take a walk into the briefing room, where I'm going to give you my view from the blue.
The briefing room. Headlines, stories, and all that touches American law enforcement.
I want to talk to you about something that's taking place in Baton Rouge as we speak. After almost a year, the Department of Justice, the United States Department of Justice, has cleared the two Baton Rouge police officers who were involved in the shooting death of Alton Sterling. Now, you'll remember this because this was a very, very high-profile shooting that caused a great deal of consternation and violence from protests. Alton Sterling, first of all, was an ex-felon. He was an ex-felon who had also had an armed encounter with the police prior to this particular night. The police were called because Alton Sterling was standing outside of a convenience store and he was selling CDs. This was apparently what he did on a frequent basis. However, somebody called the police because he had threatened someone with a gun. So the police are called to an armed man who has threatened someone with a gun. And he's a very, very large fellow. When the police got there, they tried to take him into custody. And during that time, they tried to deploy a taser. It didn't work. And then they went hands-on with him. And apparently during the arrest process, where they were trying to get control of him, one of the police officers threatened to shoot him. Now, that sounds bad on paper, but in reality, if you know that a subject is armed, or you suspect that the subject is armed, and you announce, "Don't move or I'll shoot," that's not necessarily a bad thing. You want to make sure that this guy knows that you mean business. Now, why is that important? It'll play into what I tell you in just a few moments. So the officers try to take him into custody. He resists. He fights. The officers take him to the ground. Now, it's also important to know that there were people around videotaping this, of course, and there was also security footage from the convenience store. But what everybody saw was these two police officers on top of Alton Sterling, and during the battle, and that's what it was. It was a battle. You could hear one of the officers say, "He's got a gun, he's got a gun." And the other officer saying something along the lines of, you better not, or I swear to God," of obviously indicating that if he went for that gun, that he was going to shoot him. And then you heard the other officer, he's going for the gun, and then gunshots. And Alton Sterling was shot to death by one of the officers. Well, you would think that the police executed a pillar of society who was selling tulips on the sidewalk for what the outcry was. Once again, the racism card played in a big way. Riots happened. The public demanded the heads of these two police officers. And then the Department of Justice stepped in and said, we will do the investigation. Now, okay, Department of Justice, I understand. Take a look at it. Usually, that's not the process. Usually, it's done by the state authorities. But in this case, Department of Justice took over. Now, this was almost a year ago now. The two police officers have been on administrative leave since. And I'm going to get into what punishment that is for them in just a minute, too. But so the Department of Justice has had this case all the time. And it's been like rubbing a raw nerve in the community of Baton Rouge. Well, today, the Department of Justice announced that they were clearing the two officers of any wrongdoing in the shooting. That should be cause for celebration in the law enforcement community, because these officers did nothing wrong. They saved their own lives. And the real victims here are those two police officers. Now, in Baton Rouge, it's one of the lowest paid police departments in the country. They make somewhere around $30,000 a year. These officers who are on administrative leave, once they're on administrative leave, they're not allowed to work any of their, they call them extra jobs or side jobs. And that's where they actually make enough money to live. So in essence, these officers have been penalized for doing their duty. Plus, they have been under threat of life. They have had to move. Their wives had to leave their jobs because of the threats. So who are the victims here? The victims are the police. So you would think that today's good news, when that came out, that the Department of Justice was not going to prosecute, and that they found that these officers acted properly, that would be cause for celebration. But in what I'm absolutely boggled my mind is that the Attorney General of Louisiana has now come out and said that he's going to look at them to prosecute them. And what he cited as a reason for this action is what I told you about at the very beginning of this tale, that the officer or one of the officers threatened to shoot Alton Sterling while they were trying to get control of him. How they're going to be utilizing that in order to say that these officers did something untoward is something that I cannot fathom. But the fact that the state's attorney, that the attorney general of that state, is now threatening prosecution of these two cops who did nothing except defend their own lives from an armed, dangerous suspect is so disturbing. And I know that it's politically motivated. You know it, right? As sure as I am sitting here, they are looking for a way to appease the community. Now, once again, the family of Alton Sterling is blaming everything on the police. And the lawyers are involved, and of course there's going to be lawsuits. And somehow, the fact that Alton Sterling decided to arm himself, knowing that he's an ex-felon for child molestation, and knowing that he is not allowed to possess a firearm, and then he fights with the police, he tries to get to the gun, and he's killed. Well, who made that decision? Mr. Sterling? That wasn't the police that made that decision. That was you that made that decision. But who's going to bear the brunt of this? It's going to be those two cops. Now, in the meantime, with this announcement taking place literally just hours ago, the police are gearing up for what may very well be another series of riots, civil unrest, and violence towards the community and towards the police. Louisiana has seen a number of police officers killed in the line of duty this last year and this year. And the massacre that took place as a result of these shootings of Baton Rouge police and East Baton Rouge sheriff's officers really points to how dangerous this situation is. And the problem is, where is the justice? One part of this justice has been decided by the United States Department of Justice, who ruled this shooting justifiable. That's where it should end. To once again take police officers and prosecute them for simply defending themselves is unconscionable. The Attorney General needs to have the guts to stand up and do the right thing. Now, if there is something other than what we know about that took place, much of the evidence has not been made public yet, but you can guarantee that when the United States Department of Justice is looking at this case as a violation of civil rights, the bar for that is much lower than the criminal charges of murder, second degree, or manslaughter. So if there had been evidence there, they would have, without a shadow of a doubt, prosecuted these officers. They didn't. And this is where it should end right now. Unfortunately, I think that once again, politics is going to play a role in the lives of those cops. If you haven't figured it out already, I am the national spokesman for Blue Lives Matter. And the Blue Lives Matter website is where you want to go when you want information about everything that's going on in the law enforcement world. BlueLivesMatter.blue. That's our website, BlueLivesMatter.blue. And that's where you can show your support to the American law enforcement officer for all your news and information about everything that's going on in law enforcement. The website that you want to go to is BlueLivesMatter.blue. And that is where the official website of Blue Lives Matter is. You will read articles written by cops and police supporters. You will find out everything that's going on in the law enforcement community. You can show your support by becoming a member of Blue Lives Matter. And there will always be additional opportunities and information that you will find entertaining and informative. BlueLivesMatter.blue. If you have security needs, that is, if your company needs security, we all need security, right? But if your company needs security or your business, the person you want to talk to is Doug Carter of JSD Protective Services. That's JSDProtectiveServices.com. Go check out their website. Now, I'm really impressed with their operation. I've met their folks. I've met Doug and his commitment to the top training for these security officers is pretty impressive. These men and women that work for him are consummate security professionals, and they've got armed security. They do pretty much everything in the realm of security, which includes bodyguarding, private investigation, and they're all over the United States. So check them out, JSD Protective Services. Tell them Randy sent you. I want to give you one more view from the blue, and this involves politics again. You know, it seems like every time I talk about something that is wrong when it comes down to law enforcement, it's not because of the police, it's because of the politics. Now, this is about what is taking place in New York. Not New York City, but on Long Island. In mid-April, there was a horrible, horrendous quadruple murder. And it certainly raised national attention of one of the most horrendous, dangerous criminal gangs to infect our nation. It's called MS-13. Now, let me give you just a little background about MS-13. It's a criminal street gang that was actually born right here in the United States. But its makeup are all Central Americans, Honduras, Guatemalans, but mostly Salvadorians. And they are the most vicious organization that you can imagine. Unfortunately, they're in 40 states now, and they're estimated to have somewhere around 40,000 members. That's a lot of dangerous people. So they have infected Long Island, and the police there have been battling them for quite a while. And they're exceedingly murderous. And on April 16th, four young men, ages 16 to 20, were, it's almost unconscionable, they were hacked to death with machetes by a group of MS-13. They were brutalized and tortured, and then they were chopped up into pieces of arms and legs and gore and severed heads and left in a pile to be discovered. Now, why did they inflict this type of damage on these four young men who all reportedly were not members of this group? Well, the answer is simple: terror. They want to terrorize the community of Long Island. They want to show that they are not afraid of the police, not afraid of the government. And they did so in such a graphic way. Now, that horror has led to a pretty harsh combination of, shall we say, ways and means to end this gang, both by the federal government and local and state government. So, like I said, the Long Island cops have been battling these guys for a long time. The governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, he came out with some real tough talk. He's going to end MS-13. He's assigning 25 troopers to the task force. He's going to, I mean, he got as much ink as he possibly could. And he was a tough-talking son of a gun. Well, then, Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General of the United States, said that they were thinking about making this designation of this group a foreign terrorist organization, which would grant even more federal tools, if you will, to take them down. And then what does Andrew Cuomo do? He comes out with another statement and says that these troopers will use all the tools at their disposal except immigration. Okay. So one of the major tools that could be utilized here are the immigration laws, because so many of these individuals are here illegally. Why would you not use all of the laws? And instead, what does Andrew Cuomo do? He comes out at, talking out of one side of his mouth, we're gonna end the thug rule of MS-13. And then in the next breath he says, oh, but we're not going to use the immigration laws. And why not? Of course, because of his political agenda. This is, once again, everything that is wrong with a politician. Instead of really caring about their communities, really caring about doing the right thing, they play their own politics for their own agendas. And Andrew Cuomo is exactly like most of those individuals that are more concerned with their own political futures than they are with the people they have sworn to protect. And that, my friends, is my view from the blue. If this was television and you could see me right now, you know that I'd be wearing a Warrior 12 t-shirt. And you're asking yourself, what the hell is a Warrior 12 t-shirt? That is, unless you've been listening to this show for a while. Then you would know that they are the coolest police t-shirts around. Warrior 12 is the clothing line for Blue Lives Matter. So we got the Blue Lives Matter t-shirts. We have all kinds of other different logos and sayings on them, and they are very, very cool. So go to warrior12.com. That's warrior12.com. You could check out the entire line and wear some pretty cool shirts.
We are excited indeed to be celebrating our one-year anniversary here at America Out Loud. And we could not have done it without you. Well, in short order, we've become one of the fastest-growing podcast and talk radio networks in the world. For all the latest news, entertainment, your blogging, and now web TV, as we celebrate our one-year anniversary here, and we'll see you back at AmericaOutLoud.com. Well, I'm not sure why we take our health for granted, but I know that many of us do, include me in that company. Recently, I had a couple of health scares that got my attention real quick. I started a new product called Healthy Cell. I took it for about 3 weeks, and man, I started to feel really good. I found myself sleeping better at night, had more energy in the day, and less stress and anxieties, and just feeling better overall. Well, with those kind of results, I knew I had to do something, so I reached to the company directly with a request to bring Healthy Cell back to America Out Loud, and here it is. Well, typically you'd pay $110 plus shipping and handling. Well, now you get it for just $79.99 for the monthly plan, plus free shipping. That's right, they'll pick up the shipping, and you pay just $79.99. Use the code OUTLOUD on HealthyCell.com, or just click the banner on the front page of AmericaOutLoud.com.
With me today in the interview room at Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, is a law enforcement officer and author. And she's got a very interesting story to tell. Police officer Jamie Rooney of the York, Maine Police Department. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Jamie.
Oh, Randy, thank you so much for having me. I truly appreciate that. Thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You have recently written a book. Your story is fascinating. But first, before we go into the book itself, tell us a little bit about your police career.
Oh, definitely. So I've been a full-time police officer for the town of York in York, Maine, which is right near, it's 10 minutes from Portsmouth, New Hampshire, coastal town. I've been here for just over 17 years full-time. I've dedicated my career to working with the youth and those less fortunate in our community and other communities around us. The last 12 years, I've been in the schools, creating new programs. Anytime there's a need or I see something like technology changing every day, I try to keep up with it and bring resources to the community that can help our kids stay safe and educate our parents so they can try to manage them.
Yeah, that's
what I do.
That's always a challenge.
Yeah, it is a challenge.
How big is the town of York?
Town of York is about 60 square miles. Half of that is a beach front right up the coast of Maine. And then the other side of the town is more rural. And we have in York, we have a mountain, Mount Agamanicus. You can go hiking and go surfing in the same day. It's a beautiful community.
Nice. Very nice. How many yeah. officers on the department?
Altogether, we're close to 30 officers.
Okay.
But in the summertime, we pick up. We pick up a lot of seasonal help because our population quadruples
gotcha.
For the tourist season.
Right, right. Well, let's get, your path to becoming an author is very interesting. Why don't you tell us about your book? Your book is called Black to Blue. And it's a very interesting story. Tell my listeners about it.
Oh, definitely. Thank you. So the book, Black to Blue, I wasn't going to write a book. I had no intention on writing a book. But
funny how that happens.
My, Oh my gosh, it just, yeah, it came, right? You know, ha, huh, you know. So it really, my father passed away a couple years ago. And when he was kind of in that process of going, and I was going to the hospital every weekend, I was driving in the car and I had this moment, you know, those moments where you just kind of stop and you kind of get hit in the face with something. And it was the moment that I realized that, you know, what would happen if something happened to me tomorrow and my children didn't know my story? Because my children have a great life. They're very fortunate. They have a beautiful, lovely, comfy bed to sleep in at night. They have a mom that kisses them every night and says, I love you. They have plenty of food. They don't want for anything, nor should they. But, you know, my story is very different from that. And I've sheltered my children from that. But I thought about that. And I thought about how important it would be for them to know, really know about their mom when they're older. And that I wanted them to know that, you know, sometimes life is really hard. Life is really hard. And you're going to be thrown some stuff you're not going to think you can handle, but you can. And that there is a light at the end of that tunnel. So I thought, okay, I'll take two or three what I call defining moments, those moments in your life when something happens and you're kind of at that fork in the road or that point where you're like, holy crap, I got to do something. Something's got to change or else this is not good, you know? And so I started with those. I started thinking I would just write my defining moments, these things, these challenges that I had. And once I started writing, I couldn't stop. And that, it didn't work to jump in and write a defining moment. I had to start from the beginning. And then what I realized really quickly is I couldn't stop. You know, it came flowing out of me, my story, but also it was therapeutic for me. I hadn't dealt with a lot of things. And it was, frankly, it was like opening Pandora's box. My mother was a drug addict, alcoholic. We lived in the projects in Worcester, Massachusetts. We lived in Great Brook Valley projects. We were a minority. That didn't matter to me. I was really always good at making friends and making sure I made the right friends. So I always had the big kids. I always had the tough kids. You know, they always thought I was cute. I was this little tiny toehead bouncing around with an attitude, a chip on my shoulder, and a mouth. So, you know, growing up in the projects, it's a completely different life. We had four kids and a single mom. Four of us we'd share a room, mattresses on the floor, roach infested. You know, our pillows were sweatshirts rolled up, tucking in the arms. You know, our curtains were old sheets that you could pretty much see through. And my mother had a lot of different boyfriends along the way. There are times in my life when I was abused, you know, obviously physically, but also sexually. I was exposed to drugs constantly, you know, having people snorting coke on the table or pot was like cigarettes. That was no big deal. I used to buy pot for my mother. She taught me how to hold it in my hand and cup it up my sleeve so I wouldn't bend her joint. She used to call them bones.
So wait a minute, how old were you when your mom was having you buy dope for her?
Just a kid. I lived in the projects from the age of 6 until the age of 12. So all throughout that time, as far back as I can remember, I don't know distinctly the exact age. I just remember she'd give me the money, roll it up. I'd walk to the apartment number. I knew where I was going. I'd knock on the door. The guy would come, I'd hand him the money first, and then he'd hand me the joints. And I remember cupping them up in my hand, in my sleeve, so nobody could see them, but also so I didn't bend them. My mother's joint, right? Isn't that crazy thinking of it now? But, you know, it wasn't unusual. And the thing is, like, especially, you know, the first of the month, everyone jokes about the first of the month. But when you're living in that environment and those checks start rolling in, and even food stamps, I'd watch my mother when she'd get her food stamps, people would come and she'd sell $100 worth of food stamps for $50 cash. So needless to say, we didn't have any food. We didn't have any clothes. We didn't have anything provided for us. So we had to figure out how to get it. And I was the mother of my siblings. I have an older sister, but so I was very quiet and timid. And then I have a younger brother and sister who were 6 years younger than I. So I was the provider. I'd go to the food pantry. They didn't call them food pantries back then. You went to wherever they were giving away free food. I walk through the line with my banana box, and I'd get, you know, enough food for a mother with four kids, and I'd make up an excuse why my mother wasn't there, and you know, I did it, and I carried the stuff home, and I provided. And then the other thing was the clothing. I'd dig out of the lost and found box. That's where I got most of my stuff. Shoes. When my shoes started to wear off, I used to walk into the local, it was theirs back then turned into Ames now. They're all Walmarts. But I'd walk in, I'd kick off my shoes, shove them under the counter, under the shoe rack, put on a new pair, and I'd walk right back out. I walked with confidence. Nobody ever asked me. Nobody ever questioned me. I never got stopped. And I stole shoes my entire childhood. Wow. And it did come out in my polygraph, by the way. That came out in my polygraph, so I was good. No, I had to tell my chief all that stuff, and thankfully he was really great about it. But everything that we had, you know, we had to survive, and we had to find out ways to get it. If I was cold and there was a sweatshirt hanging on the clothesline, I stole it. I took it. I borrowed it. I just never returned it. So as I was, I started writing, you know, all these memories came flooding back, the good, the bad. Some make you crack up, and then other ones make you cry. You know, it's awful. It's devastating, the things that people do to other people, you know, especially in that kind of an environment. I'd wake up in the morning and there'd be strangers passed out on my floor. Half of them had, you know, peed their pants, and they didn't even know, you know, what the night had looked like before. But my story is a huge part of why I became a police officer, because back then it was before you called it community policing. But whenever the cops came, and they came a lot, someone was going to jail. But whenever they came, they always made me feel better. And I remember, like, the guys, they'd always check in with me. They'd always be like, "You okay, kid? Okay, you're going to be fine, kid. Go to bed, kid. You know, it's going to be better tomorrow, kid." Whatever it was always that. I always felt better, and I always felt safe when they came. And it got to the point where I was the one calling them, because everybody would have been partying all day, you know, at the house, and all these people, inevitably someone would get angry about something, and they'd go off and start fighting. And then it needed to stop, because I'm in a bedroom with three siblings and it's 2 o'clock in the morning and I wanted to go to sleep. So I'd get mad. I'd go out, I'd get the phone, or I'd sneak out of the apartment if my mother hid the phone, because she caught on pretty quickly that I'd call. And I called.
Well, I'm sure that made you popular.
Oh, I didn't care. That's the thing. Like, I always had this little, like, I knew I was doing the right thing. And really, it came down to, like, taking care of my family. And my mother was checked out. You know, she never parented. She was present. She was there. But she never took on that role. So somebody had to. So, you know, I dressed my siblings and cooked for them, make sure they had what they wanted. But then as I became a teenager, I started finding myself in situations that were more high risk. You know, staying over friends' houses or coming home at 2 a.m., at 11, 12 years old, and my mother wouldn't even ask me where I'd been. And that's when one of those defining moments happened, and I was assaulted by one of my best friend's uncles. And I was trying to help his daughter go to sleep. That's what I did. I put her to sleep because it was, you know, it was around midnight, 1 o'clock, I don't know, and she came out of the bedroom. She's 5 years old, and she asked if I'd lay with her because she couldn't sleep. She's crying, and I put her to sleep. And her father had been drinking all day and took that opportunity to come into the room. And the thing about that, you know, that incident that bothered me the most was that my friends were wide awake and they were right on the other side of the door, and nobody came in to help me.
How old were you then?
That's when I was 12. And so I ran out of there. I got away from him, you know, after he had assaulted me, and I ran all the way home through the projects, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, who's out at 2 o'clock in the morning in the project? So I was scared out of my mind. So I ran all the way home. It was about 6 blocks down. And when I got to the door, I remember banging on the door for my mom to let me in. And I was petrified, scared out of my mind. I can't even imagine the look on my face. And she just opened the door and said, "Go to bed." And I said, okay, I'm going to bed.
You had just
and
been,
I went to
hold
bed.
On a second. You had just been sexually assaulted and...
Yep.
Ran home, and besides the fact that it's shocking, it's did you think about calling the police?
Oh, it's devastating. No, I didn't, because, you know, I was so hurt And these were my best friends. You know, these were my people. These are the ones I hung out, my homies. You know, we called them homies back then. We were together every day. And I was more devastated by their non-action, you know, by them not saying or doing anything, than I was by what that uncle had done to me. You know, he's in control of what he did, and he owns that, and I don't own. But I was more devastated and hurt by what they did. I didn't know what to do with it. You know what I mean? I didn't know what to do with it. I was in shock. And then when my mother opened the door, she's high as a kite. My mother was heroin, coke, everything. You name it, my mother did it. And I just went to bed, and I remember I laid there all night, wide awake, and I just thought, you got to do something. This is not going to be your life. You know, this is not going to be your life. And so the next day I picked up the phone and I called my dad, who lived in Jackson, Maine. Now, this is a dirt road town, no stores, no post office, not even a gas station. They don't have anything. Little dirt road, very poor community, you know, back then, especially our family, we didn't have any money. And I called him and I said, you know, Dad, I'm starting to get into trouble here. I'm really worried about, you know, getting hurt. I need you to come get me. And it took about 2 weeks. And my father, who had really, he hadn't been, I saw him a little bit during the summertime as a kid. You know, occasionally we come up for the summer, spend a couple weeks, but typically I stayed with my grandparents. My parents were married at 20. He was a really young parent. So I don't know what it was. He must have heard it in my voice. Whatever it was, he came down in 2 weeks and picked me up. So I went from Worcester, Massachusetts, projects, craziness, to Jackson, Maine. You know, and I into eighth grade and then high school. I finished out high school there. The problem with Jackson, Maine was that my stepmother was an opiate user, and she's also very abusive. She was more physically abusive than anything. But I knew that.
You went from your mother, yeah, who was a heroin addict and every other type of drug, to your father's house, where his wife was also a doper.
Yeah, she loved her pills. And what she'd do is and we knew that she was doing it, she'd doctor shop. So she'd have three different doctors and complain of the same back pain. And then she'd even drive an hour and a half, 2 hours to a doctor's office in, like, I think it was Canaan, Maine or somewhere out there. And they'd go to get her prescription filled there. And then she'd go to the other one, or she'd call up and say, oh, I accidentally dumped them, you know, whatever it was that she did. It got progressively worse as we got older, the opiate use. There was just something, you know, the wiring was off with her. There's, you know, those people that they just snap and you don't know why or when it's coming. It just comes and it's like a hurricane. Well, that was her. Her name is Red, and her real name in the book is Red, but also in real life, that's what we called her, because she always dyed her hair bright red, but it wasn't because of her hair more as it was her temper. And my father was, you know, he was working three jobs. Sometimes he was gone for months doing different jobs. He didn't make a lot of money. He just took whatever he could find. And she was stuck with raising his kids, and she was angry, you know. So I'd be sitting on the couch or chair, and I'd be watching a show, and she'd walk by and say, what are you smirking at? Belt me across the face, throw me on the floor. You know, there were so many incidents of that, but that all kind of came to a head when I was 16. I came home late from a friend's house. My friend's dad, had gotten held over at work, and he called me and said, I'm going to be late. And we didn't have a house phone at the time. We really didn't have any money. We didn't have a house phone. So I tried to call my grandmother to get the message to Red that I was going to be late. And my grandmother, however, the message didn't happen. I walked in the door and Red beat the living crap out of me. She ended up in the hospital. Two black eyes. My face was unrecognizable. It was unbelievable. And then from there, so I got emancipated. I wasn't allowed to go back to the house. I got emancipated, and I've been on my own ever since. I was 16 years old.
That is a hell of a story.
There's a lot in between, but that, yeah, that's my story. I've been on my own since 16 and joined the crew of law enforcement. Geez, when I was 19, I was hired as a summer, like a reserves officer. Back then you could do it at 19. So I was carrying a gun at 19, had no business. Right. But I've been on my own since I was 16. Worked through college, worked three jobs, did everything I did anything and everything, any job I could get to pay for that. And ended up in York, Maine. At 20, I was hired as a dispatcher, communications specialist. And within that year, I got a job offer. So when I turned 21, I was just at the end of 21, actually, I was going to a police academy. And I've been doing it ever since.
How did your interactions with the law enforcement officers that you interacted with quite regularly, how did that affect your opinion to move into law enforcement as a career, especially at such a young age?
Oh, that's the thing. That was the point. Those were officers that came around the projects. The officers that I had incidents with were, you know, they always made it better. I always felt safe when they were there, and they always took that. These guys, they knew what they were doing. They got down. They looked at me in the eye. They told me it was going to be okay. They told me I could get through it. And then there was this day, I remember we were standing outside in the projects, right outside our apartment. There was a basketball court, and all the guys are playing basketball, and, you know, we're just standing there watching them. We think we're cool. And a cruiser pulls up, and two cops get out of the cruiser, and we're all like, oh, bleep, you know, someone's going to jail, right? Everyone's joking and laughing. I never told my friends I love the police. I wouldn't have had any friends. But so we're all like, oh, bleep, you know, who's going to jail? Raphael's going to jail. And they walk up and they're like, hey, can we pray? You know? And I remember being just like stunned, and I'm watching them. They've got all the gear and things are bouncing around. And of course, you know, the project guys kill them at the game. But it was awesome because they were joking, and even the guys were laughing. Like, everyone was just, it just erupted in this wonderful feeling, right? And then they weren't the bad guys. They weren't coming to take someone away. They wanted to play with the project kids, you know, the kids that people don't necessarily, people go the other way when they see the project kids up there or down there. And then I remember one came over, and he's like, there's three of us little girls. And he's like, hey, you guys want a piece of gum? And he broke out this Trident pack of gum. And I remember being like, oh, man, cops must make good money. And he's giving us gum. Like, I'm thinking, oh, they must make, like, I thought, I don't know why I thought that. I just remember having that moment where I was like, wow, these guys are awesome. And so as I, you know, as I matured and I grew up and I went through all the garbage and stuff that happened to me, it was always there. And then when I had that incident, you know, with my stepmother, and she pummeled me. When I went to the ER, I remember the nurse couldn't even look me in the face. She couldn't even look at my face. She was like tearing up. And I just kept thinking, I'm good, because I'm not going back. I'm good, right? So I was empowered at that point, even though I'm definitely devastated. But a Waldo County deputy, came in and sat with me. And he could have done his interview and left and did his work, you know, but he stayed with me. He stayed with me for a very long time. And we talked about, what do I want to do with my future? What does that look like? What can I do? And I told him what I wanted to do. And he said, okay, so this is what you got to do. And then you got to do this. But if you're going to get emancipated, you got to get good grades, maybe get a job, show that you can support yourself. So within a week, I had a job at the local IGA. My grades went from, you know, average B's and C's to A's and B's through the roof, because I no longer had that pressure at home. I was sleeping on my friend's couch. I didn't care. They loved having me there because I cleaned their house from top to bottom. I was so appreciative that they had taken me in. And I was, you know, it was November, so I just had to get to June. I just had to get to June, graduate, and then I could go and do what I needed to do. And when I left that house, I had a garbage bag of clothes, and I was so proud to leave that house with my garbage bag. I was so proud to have that garbage bag of clothes. When I left my dad's house, when I went and grabbed some things to move in or to stay at my friend's house, I had a garbage bag of clothes. And then when I went to college, I was dropped off by my aunt. She literally left me at the steps. She pulled up and let me get out of the car. I had a garbage bag of clothes, and I had some food stamps in my pocket. And I was so liberated. I was so proud. I didn't care. And, you know, and then from there, I took off. You couldn't stop it. You couldn't stop what I wanted to do. So now that's what I do. I focus on kids. I really spend a lot of time in the classroom. 85% of my time, I'm interacting with kids. I play dodgeball. I play kickball. I tried doing cartwheels yesterday. It wasn't super pretty, but I did it. But I want the kids, right? I want the kids to, like, get that. You know, we're people, and the uniform is a great thing, but there's somebody underneath there and we care about them. And I want them to, I want to build that trust and comfort because I want them to come to me when they need something.
Have you found little girls that were basically going through the same type of insanity as you went through?
Oh, absolutely. In different ways. But when I published the book, it was amazing. You know, I transferred to the middle school. I'd been in the high school for 9 years. And all of a sudden, I was like the most popular person at the high school because these girls picked up the book and they started reading it. I just gave the school a bunch of books. I'm like, here, I want, put them out there. And then the adult ed, not adult ed, alternative education classes, you know, those high-risk girls, they're in those classes, they read the book. And then I went and I sat with them and I talked to them about it. And then from there, I got, you know, obviously I got some reports and they felt, you know, because they knew that I was the real deal. They knew that I understood what they had been through. And I had, you know, that instant trust. I had credibility. So from that came all of this amazing work that I was able to do with them and help them. And also adult women who are in their 30s, 40s, and 50s have reached out to me and said, thank you so much for sharing your story. I've never gotten help. I've never talked about it. I'm going to go and get help. I'm going to go and talk to someone. I need to figure this out. I don't want the rest of my life to be the way that it's been. You know, it's about not being a victim. It's about empowering yourself. And if I can do that, if I have to share my story, if that helps people to come out and get the healing that they need, hey, all right, let's do it. You know, I can't sit on it. I can't hold it in anymore. I was really good at compartmentalizing things when I was younger. I just put things away. But as you get older, that gets a lot harder to do.
Sure.
So writing, it was great. I think everyone should write a book. Doesn't mean you publish it and go out in front of public because it's really, you know, that's pretty tough. But gosh, you know, just to write down your story and part of your legacy and who you are for your family, for your kids, I think that's just such a gift. It's more of a gift for yourself, but awesome.
Let me ask you this. Did out of all this time that has passed, did you ever decide to seek professional help?
Oh, yeah. No, I've been through therapy. Oh, yeah. I definitely. And you got to find the right one. You know, you got to go through a couple because the first couple just kind of told me what I wanted to hear and nodded a lot. And then I found a woman that I could really talk to. And not that she had the same experiences, but she was like, wow, you know, she didn't pretend to get everything. She just genuinely just heard me out and then offered tools. You know, I never did yoga or meditation until I was in my 30s, you know, but I found a way to calm my body. I'm one of those people, they call me the blonde tornado at work because I'm like 900 miles an hour. I don't know how to I don't have a medium. I have a high and an off. So I'll go fast forward all day long and then I hit the couch at night and I fall asleep at 7:30, 8 o'clock on the couch because I've been 90 miles an hour all day.
I believe
so
it.
Things like that.
Well, you know, and let's talk about, you know, you recently, you originally self-published the book,
yes.
Right? Well, you know, yes. I think it's really important that the fact that that your book has now been picked up by a publisher.
Yeah, so I've got a large print publishing company. It's in the works right now, which is great. I'm also working on finding a regular print. When you self-publish, boy, I wish I'd taken a course on it because there's so much to it that you don't know. And like I said, I didn't intend on publishing it. And then I had a couple friends, and one's a writer and pretty significant in our area, well-known. And he's like, Jamie, you got to do this. You got to publish this. And pros and cons, you know, weighed it all out. And then now that I've done it, I'm so glad that I did it. You know, I wouldn't change it for the world, but there's a lot of things that I would have done differently had I known then what I know now about self-publishing. The book's going, it's being printed in large print and new cover. And, you know, I like the cover anyways, but we're going to kind of brighten it up a little bit and hard and soft copies and get it. Schools are using it. I've got 4 schools using the current version for alternative ed classes. My high school, Mount View, just took it on for their seniors. a couple of schools, a school in Kittery, just, you know, those kinds of smaller groups. I get the books out to them, and the girls especially, boy, they love the book. And then I go and I try to sit with the girls or the students and talk about it. And then sometimes they share, sometimes they just listen, but they always get something out of it, you know.
You're sharing something that is so personal and at the same time universal in your feelings. I mean, it truly is, it's all about legacy. And yes, the fact that you are touching the lives of so many. Now, how can people get the book?
My book is on Amazon under Black to Blue.
That's excellent. Okay, so the book, once again, is called Black to Blue by Jamie Rooney. That's Rooney. Once again, I want to thank you so much for coming on to Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, telling your story. You are truly an inspiration. Not only as a survivor, but as a law enforcement officer, and you are leaving your legacy in a lot of different ways. And so once again, the name of the book, Black to Blue, available Amazon and Barnes & Noble for the electronic version. And you can find Jamie, that's Jamie Rooney, Rooney, at Facebook under Jamie Rooney Authors page. Jamie, thanks so much, and we'll talk soon.
End of watch.
Each week on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, we commemorate the lives of those officers who have been lost in the line of duty. This week, two officers were killed in the line of duty. Deputy Sheriff Justin L. Beard of the Quachta Parish Sheriff's Office in Louisiana. Deputy Sheriff Justin Beard was killed in a vehicle crash while responding to a burglary alarm during a severe thunderstorm at approximately 6 a.m. He was traveling on Louisiana Highway 34 south of West Monroe when his patrol vehicle left the roadway, struck an embankment, and overturned. Deputy Beard, who was not wearing a seatbelt, suffered fatal injuries. He served with the Quachta Parish Sheriff's Office for 3.5 years and is survived by his wife and 3 children. His end of watch, Sunday, April 30th, 2017. The second officer to die in the line of duty, Deputy Sheriff Mark Burbridge of the Pottawatomie County Sheriff's Office in Iowa. Deputy Sheriff Mark Burbridge was shot and killed at the Pottawatomie County Jail in Council Bluffs as he and another deputy returned 2 inmates to the jail after a court appearance. As the deputies began to take the inmates into the jail, one of the inmates attacked them. The inmate was able to disarm one of the deputies and shoot them both. He then stole the transport van and fled from the jail. He shot a citizen nearby when he attempted to carjack the man. He then abducted another citizen and forced her to drive him from the scene in her vehicle. The subject was located by Omaha, Nebraska police officers after releasing the woman. He was taken into custody following high-speed pursuit and charged with numerous felonies related to the carjacking and weapons possession. The man had just been sentenced to 55 years in prison for pleading guilty to murder. Deputy Burbridge had served with the Pottawatomie County Sheriff's Office for 12 years. His end of watch, Monday, May 1st, 2017. These officers made the ultimate sacrifice. May they rest in peace. Thanks so much for joining me this week on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. I really do appreciate your support. Feel free to contact me at randysutton@americaoutloud.com for your comments. Thanks so much. I'll see you next week.